helping students and healthcare professionals not just survive, but thrive with a purpose. This is the CMDA Student Pulse Podcast with your host, Bill Reichart, National Director of CMDA Campus Ministries.
Well, welcome to another episode of CMDA's Student Pulse Podcast. I'm Bill Reichart, National Director for our Campus and Community Ministries here at CMDA. And my guest today is Dr. Tim Morgenthaler. Tim, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me, Bill.
Well, we're going to be talking about sleep, and we're going to dive right into it. Tim's latest book. But before we do, too, let me just give a biographical sketch of Tim and his work as a physician. Dr. Morgenthaler is a professor of medicine in the Division of Pulmonary Critical Care and Sleep Medicine. Tim has served as the director for the Center of Sleep Medicine at Mayo Clinic from 2016 to recently 2024. He is the father to five and grandfather to five. All right. That's a blessing. And married to Robin, his bride, for 40 years. Again, welcome, Tim.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Now, let me just parenthetically say here that some of you been around CMDA for a while might recognize the last name. And as I mentioned in the bio, married to Robin Morgenthaler, who for many years, was the founder, for many years, the director of a side-by-side ministry, which has been a blessing to so many families, so many individuals, and now currently in the hands of Rebecca Lehman and the work she's doing. But she's been a tremendous blessing to the work and ministry of CMDA. And Tim, this book, I'll say too, is a real blessing to those who read it. It's a subject that is just ubiquitous. I mean, we all sleep. We all deal with sleep. We all have challenges with sleep. And so I appreciate you having taken the time to write this book.
Yeah. No, and so, you know, a couple things. Yes, my wife, Robin, I think it was in 1988, is she really felt the call to start that ministry side by side. And so that started in our kitchen. And so I'm so pleased with, you know, how the Lord has used that over the years and seen it grown and change. And it's been a huge blessing to me and my family, and I hope it has been to others as well. Sleep is extremely important, and sleep medicine has been just a real joy for my life in terms of practice. But you're in charge of the questions. I'll let you go.
Well, you're kind of leading into the place I want to go, Tim, is, you know, your background in pulmonary and critical care, but you chose to kind of lean into the sleep medicine piece of it. Just tell us a little bit what drew you into that area of medicine. And why do you why do you believe it's so vital too?
So I'll do that maybe in reverse order. You know, you, they often say that you can tell how important something is to someone by opening up their calendar and looking to see where they spend their time. And, you know, I think if we're real honest with ourselves, we're probably intended to spend about a third of our time asleep. And it's been that way since day seven of creation, because as soon as man landed on the earth, God had already set up the night and the day. And already the next events, you know, in the first three chapters of Genesis find God assisting Adam into a deep sleep. So sleep has been important since the creation of man, since the very beginning. Sleep isn't just about feeling refreshed. It's really quite essential because it supports nearly every system in our body. And, you know, maybe we'll have a chance to talk about that. Now, how did I get interested in sleep medicine? Like so many things, you know, you look back and you say, well, what a coincidence, if you believe in coincidences. But when I went to medical school, I went to Dartmouth Medical School. And as it turns out, when I attended medical school, I was at one of only two medical schools in the country that had any units on sleep medicine. And it just happened to be taught by a very great guy whose name was Peter Howry. He was a PhD. And right away, I found it fascinating that there's this field of medicine, if you will, that no one else was talking about and yet occupies a third of your life and affects every single other body system. So it intrigued me. Now, I didn't pursue that fully when I was in medical school. I started off in surgery. I did a Navy scholarship, and that was another part of my life. But I eventually came back around to saying, you know, I think I want to do more internal medicine, pulmonary, critical care, physiology, and maybe sleep. And wouldn't you know, as I'm literally getting on the airplane in Minneapolis to come interview at Mayo Clinic, the guy standing next to me is Peter Howry, which was, you know, now it's been 5 years or more since I'd seen the gentleman. And in that intervening time, he had moved from Dartmouth to Mayo Clinic to help found the Mayo Clinic Center for Sleep Medicine. So right away, the circumstances were kind of laid that I could pick that up.
Yeah, well, the experience and the background that you've accumulated, you've been able to pour into this book, and that's what we're going to be talking around, is a book that you just recently published, you and another author, I believe. Tell us his or her name. I'm sorry, I didn't.
So Banu Kola, he's MD, trained in the UK, and he's actually a psychiatrist has specialty boards in addiction medicine. Mm-hmm. And in our Center for Sleep Medicine here at Mayo Clinic, we have multiple specialties represented. The traditional pathways into sleep medicine have come out of psychiatry or neurology or pulmonary. Okay. And it's because of the, you know, rather complex physiology of sleep and the diseases of sleep that's been true. More recently, since about 2002 or so, it's been possible for people to enter into a sleep fellowship from internal medicine, family practice, ENT, anesthesia, a variety of other primary specialties. But it is a specialty training in and of itself.
Yeah.
But Banu is just a great colleague, very wise. Yes. It was just a lot of fun to write with him.
This book, I don't think leaves anything out. And it captured my attention. I should say the book is Mayo Clinic Guide to Better Sleep. You start off by saying something that captured my attention was, you know, we can be productive throughout the day, but really it's probably during our sleeping hours that we're the most productive. And you talk about how all these systems are being rejuvenated and repaired and all of this. And so sleep is such an important part. And yet we'll talk a little later of how we struggle with it. But just elaborate a little bit on how sleep impacts the body and mind.
So first of all, you know, sleep is when your body does all of its repair work from the day. During sleep, you know, it's especially during slow wave sleep or deep sleep, as some people call it, that your body is almost like a construction crew. I mean, it's busy fixing tissues, it's building muscle, it's strengthening bones. Growth hormone, which we know is extremely important to muscle mass and growth and body repair, it's primarily reduced during slow wave sleep. By the same token, your immune system gets a lot of a boost while you sleep, producing various cytokines that help fight infection and reduce inflammation. There's a lot of very interesting studies done that if you skimp on sleep and your body doesn't have time that it needs to heal and defend itself, you know, you're not going to react as well to a vaccine. You're going to be more susceptible to injury or illness. Professional sports teams are learning these things, and they're building whole centers at their training facilities to enhance sleep. And, you know, more and more of them, and even going down to high school teams now that are very high functioning, are talking about the importance of getting adequate sleep so the body can heal and rebuild and you can physically perform well. Mm. But that's not all. There's your brain, and it's super busy while you're snoozing. Mm. I don't know if you've ever noticed how things feel quite a bit clearer after a good night's sleep.
Yeah.
But that's because, you know, when you sleep, your brain is processing and organizing all the information that it's taken in during the day, kind of locking it down in long-term memory, doing some reorganization, especially during REM sleep. And this has kind of come to be more and more published about in the last, I'd say, 5 to 7 years, is the brain is also taking out the trash at night. It turns out that some of the byproducts of all that mental energy that's taking place during the day need to be cleared out at night. And so there's a system that has really only recently been described called the glymphatic system. Its whole job is to clear those wastes out of the brain, wastes like beta amyloid, that's, of course, linked to Alzheimer's disease. So that system is predominantly active during sleep, not so active during wakefulness. And then there's also, you know, evidence that sleep really regulates your emotions. And anybody who's ever had children know that. You know, what do you notice when they're starting to get really sleepy, right? They're crabby, but they're much better after a good night's sleep. So without enough sleep, you tend to be more stressed, irritable, snappy, those kind of things. And then I guess I'd also say, you know, since you asked, you know, metabolism and weight are hugely affected by sleep as well.
Yeah.
Sleep controls hormones like leptin and ghrelin, which manage our hunger. Ghrelin, of course, is the thing that, you know, says I'm hungry, and leptin is the thing that says I'm full. And it turns out that when we're awake too long, those go in exactly the wrong direction. They make us crave those high carb and fat snacks, which and part of the reason why epidemiologically inadequate sleep is linked very tightly with risk of obesity and diabetes and hypertension. So
That applies so much to where people live. Is you talked about weight and all. I mean, when you hear about diets and people coaching people dieting, they often say, you know, you got to get the sleep. You can't cheat yourself of that sleep. It's going to totally undercut anything you attempt to do to lose weight. So, yeah, it seems to have far-reaching impact throughout our lives. And yet, we cheat ourselves. We try to cheat ourselves of sleep. I think in some ways God is reminding us in sleep too that we are finite creatures. We are limited, yeah. But we resist it. We almost treat ourselves like machines. You know, you just got to get more out of it, got to do more. You use this term, I love this, sleep hygiene, you know, caring for ourselves. You know, we talk about good hygiene in so many other ways, but you talk about sleep hygiene. Define that phrase a little bit, and then we want to talk a little bit about some of the common mistakes people make in sabotaging their sleep.
Sure. Well, so that term sleep hygiene is used frequently, and it's kind of funny. Dr. Kohler, Banu Kohler, and myself, we argued a little bit about which term to use in there. Mm-hmm. One of my other kind of heroes in sleep medicine, a guy named Dan Bicey, who was at UPMC, he really developed a lot of, I think, what we know currently about how to approach patients with insomnia. And he kind of doesn't like the term sleep hygiene because he feels it makes it feel a little bit like, you know, you got to wash your hands or right. something. And he prefers healthy sleep habits. But whichever you prefer,
okay.
What it's really talking about are, you know, what are the circumstances that maximize the likelihood that you're going to get enough sleep? Mm. And so there's a whole list of different things that one can find. And I'm sure many of your listeners and all of us have heard some of these. I would just have to start with one of the most fundamental things, which is to actually acknowledge that we, for the most part, are not night creatures. I mean, the human body really is mostly designed to sleep at night and be awake during the day. Now, our internal clocks can be a little bit different. Some of us are more sort of evening or night owls, and some of us are a little bit more morning larks. But trying to schedule an adequate amount of time during the time when you should be sleeping is one of the most important sort of healthy sleep habits, is to say, oh, I can't cram 5 hours of sleep or 7 hours of sleep into 5 hours. I actually have to make that time. And then we have to also acknowledge that we're not like the light. You know, you switch it on in the morning, you switch it off at night. It takes most of us, you know, certain circumstances to be able to get to sleep. So what might those be? Well, taking a stimulant close to bedtime is probably not going to be in your interest. So that would be caffeine, energy drinks, nicotine products. Taking substances that are going to fragment your sleep, like alcohol close to bedtime, not going to be your friend if you're trying to improve your sleep. Exposing yourself to very bright light at night is going to kind of confuse your circadian biology, because what normally happens is as the sun falls and as we, you know, if we think back to maybe when we didn't have so much artificial lighting, as it begins to get dark, melatonin rises in our central nervous system and signals all the rest of the cells in the body that, hey, this is the time when we're going to go to sleep. So there's a whole set of biological functions that begin to happen to link us to sleep. So if you're sitting in bed with your iPhone or whatever staring you in the eyes, you know, it may not be the best circumstance for you to get to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you know, noise and security are important. If you're feeling exceedingly tense or you're threatened, it's going to be very hard to get a good night's sleep. And temperature turns out to be fairly important as well. Yeah. The human body tends to sleep better in a relatively cooler temperature than a really hot temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So those are just some things
that
could be dealt with.
No, that's great. Let's drill down on one in particular, and I kind of want to tell on myself because this is the one that I struggle with, is especially in the advent of all the new technological advances, having smartphones with us all the time. You know, how do we deal with the use of technology? And of course, you mentioned that it does affect sleep patterns. You might maybe do a little deeper dive on how it does, but then any advice on how we integrate and use technology in a way that doesn't undercut our sleep?
And I guess I would first of all say, there are some people who are sort of, anti-technology zealots when it comes to sleep.
And, okay.
You know, I went to engineering as an undergraduate. I love technology. I like using technology. But I think we do have to be smart about things. So let's talk about the underpinnings, you know, from a medical point of view of where it can get you in trouble. And then we can maybe back away from that and say, well, what's reasonable?
Okay.
So the one that most people hear about is the light. And, you know, we already kind of relayed to that. Literally, in the back of the retina, most people know there's cones and rods that are kind of helping us with peripheral vision, motion vision, and detailed vision. But there's also retinothalamic tracts that end in certain receptors in the back of the retina that are specifically designed to transmit light to the hypothalamus. And so that light becomes a very powerful, what's called in the German language, a Zeitgeber, a time giver. It's the thing that tells our internal clocks what is our relationship to the environment that we're living in. And so typically, if you watch a pattern, let's say, that doesn't have these bright lights, it's just a normal kind of a day-night type of thing. As the sun goes down, as the light goes down, and if we were measuring maybe with a catheter in your vein or something, we could begin to detect a rise in melatonin inside your system. And that melatonin is coming from the pineal gland. It turns out every cell in your body has a circadian rhythm, but a kind of, you know, you kind of need something that tells all of them, well, what time is it? And that melatonin signal coming from the hypothalamus and pituitary gland, and pineal gland rather, are really, that's kind of the synchronizer signal, if you will. So that's the principle of how our body begins in throughout the entire body begins to get the message that, oh, this is kind of when we go to sleep. So a couple things you could observe about that. One is, yep, we really are designed to sleep at night, not during the day. So, you know, many of us in healthcare end up doing shift work. We're up at night. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you might think that we could, quote unquote, get used to it. But the reality is we don't, because that's not the biology involved here. The only way you can kind of get used to it is if you can create a circumstance where you really only get light at night and you really only have darkness during the day. So you fooled yourself. You've traveled halfway across the globe environmentally.
Right.
But otherwise, that doesn't work. And so, you know, people who do shift work, we know they pay a price for it. They don't get as much sleep. Their sleep is more fragmented. It turns out that they really do have increased risks of cardiovascular risks, hypertension, stroke, heart attack. And even there's a big study that was done on nurses doing shift work in Boston, higher risk of cancer. And it's probably all these immune regulation things that get off. So the light plays a role. The other part of this has to do with, you know, sort of our behaviors and so forth. But remind me again, what was the initial question that you asked me about this? Because I started getting into the light.
No worries. It was the technology. Just how do we relate to our technology, our screen times and such as they are.
Right. Yeah. So that's right. Thank you for that, Bill. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, the other thing to just realize is that for many people, you know, most of the things in our life, the harder we try to accomplish them, the more likely we are to accomplish them. Mm. Sleep is actually the opposite of that. You can't, if you go in bed and you say, I'm going to fall asleep, I'm going to fall asleep, I'm going to fall asleep, you're less likely to fall asleep, actually. And right. So sleep has this relative special place where what we really need to do is kind of slow the brain down. And, you know, we need to let inactivity overcome us, including, you know, mental. Yeah. So if you're answering emails and doing work and contacting people and everything, even if it wasn't for the light, if you could do it with Braille, you know, let's say, right up until the second you want to fall asleep, that's not going to be as productive for some people. And so some people really struggle with going to sleep. So bringing it back to your question, technology by itself is probably not evil. Right. But if you are someone who struggles with getting to sleep, then you probably want to pay a lot of attention to things like light exposure. If you are someone who it takes you a while to kind of settle down, you probably want to evaluate.
Right.
Does technology help me settle down, or is it getting in the way of me settling down?
Yeah, you talk about kind of thinking through a winding down routine. Like you said, you just can't turn it on and turn it off. You've got to build some routines and habits that help you start to ease into it, start to prepare yourself for it. You know, going back to technology, I have an Apple Watch. I have it set for a time that's going to alert me that, okay, now's the time to start to wind down, and it kind of helps me begin to think about, okay, what do I need to do, what not to do as I prepare.
Yeah, and I mean, there's an example where technology can be helpful. You know, if you've decided that you will follow that cue and that, you know, that's when you're going to begin to shut your laptop down, you're going to, you know, there's certain things that you might want to do as you kind of have your bedtime routine to help your mind and body prepare for sleep.
Oh, that's very helpful. Well, let me turn the corner a little bit and talk about those within healthcare, those training in particular within healthcare. I think it's safe to say that sleep medicine, the things we're discussing, are not necessarily that front and center in terms of the training curriculum for many medical students. If that assumption is correct, then how can a doctor in training begin to integrate some of these things as they think about patient care?
So I guess I'd say I'd make a few observations. You know, first of all, most medical training programs, in fact, all you know, ACGME programs now have duty hours that are enforced for trainees. Interestingly enough, not so much for staff members, which is, you know, yeah. I mean, we probably need more of that than maybe our younger counterparts. But they do have hours. But nonetheless, you know, we certainly know that medical training and coverage by staff members, or when I was in private practice, you know, we are often called upon for long hours and hours at night. So we can't fight the biology and say, oh, you know, that's just not going to happen to me. The fact is that it is, and that you are going to be more prone to make errors as you become more and more sleep deprived and have your sleep interrupted. So one thing, and you know, I think most current training programs will also have mandatory educational units on fatigue mitigation. And so, you know, what are some of the things you can do? Well, if it's possible, planned naps can be helpful. You know, if you can steal away a 20 or 30 minute nap, maybe during a down period, maybe with a colleague covering you at strategic times, that can help reduce some of the consequences of this sleep deprivation. Strategically used stimulants like caffeine, if not used to excess, and if it's not somebody who's, you know, if you're not someone who's particularly sensitive to that, that can be helpful. For people who routinely do shift work and are really struggling, there actually are FDA-approved medications for improving alertness during shift work. But, you know, you're going to have to pay the piper eventually and get that sleep. So, and I would say on the other side of that, you know, if you are, let's say you're in a cycle where you're mandated to be doing a night shift, and so you know that you're going to be challenged. One of the things that we end up talking to patients and colleagues a lot about a lot is the importance of then protecting your daytime. You know, if you just decided to call your best friend at 2 o'clock in the morning because you wanted to talk about the baseball game, I think they would not be very understanding. But somehow, if you're on the night shift and they want to talk to you at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, they think that's okay. But that's your night. So if you are doing that kind of night work, you really need to take care to, you know, use darkening curtains, turn off the telephones in the room, tell your family members and neighbors to leave me alone. I need this amount of sleep, and do what you can to protect that sleep. One other thing that is just a risk in people who end up doing a lot of shift work or who end up taking a lot of night work just because of their job is we tend to be at increased risk for bad habits, like eating the wrong foods. So we tend to gain more weight. We tend to be susceptible to taking too much stimulants. And then when our sleep gets upset, there's increased problems with substance abuse, alcohol and other abuses, to try to kind of somehow regulate how you're not feeling well. And, you know, the answer to the not feeling well is probably sleep rather than alcohol or things like that. So those can be a risk, just to point out to our colleagues here online.
No, that's very helpful. Well, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the book that you and a colleague have written really does capture just about every issue, everything from sleep apnea to, you know, to medication. And so there's really very little, I don't think there's a topic that's not mentioned. So given the scope of this book and the material information in it, could you distill it? I mean, if you could, distill it down to, like, as the listeners and those watching could take away one message from this book, what would it be? What would be the also maybe a very tangible, actionable next step one might take to achieve better sleep?
So what would be the, you know, really important takeaways? The reason that Banu and I wrote that book was because, you know, over many years of practicing sleep medicine, we see people come here all the time who are suffering from not getting enough sleep or poor quality sleep or maybe even unusual things that are happening as a consequence of sleep. And I think it's very important to realize that there are answers for so many of those. And one of the things that's been so professionally gratifying is to see how many people we can actually improve their quality of life and improve the relationships that they're in and all those things by, you know, providing just good sleep medicine, to be honest with you. So I think, you know, given that probably many of the people that are listening here are in the healthcare field or are our physicians or are soon going to become physicians, NPs, PAs, don't undervalue sleep in the management of yourself or your patients. And don't think that nothing can be done, because usually something can be done, but you may have to find an expert in that area in some cases. Now, having said that, what can we all do? Well, you know, we're all learning about how it's important to stay active and how to watch what we eat because it's so important. But, you know, total health at this point, we know we also need to include getting adequate duration and, if possible, the best quality sleep. And so it can really start. I know this, again, I've said this before, but it starts with scheduling. You have your Apple Watch set to remind you when it's time to shut down. I'm guessing you turned that on because you noticed about yourself that if you didn't do that, you kept on kind of going and going and going. And then, oop, Oops, I don't have enough time, right?
Yes.
So really examine your schedule. You know, just like you examine your schedule, I'm guessing that many of your listeners are trying also to get adequate exercise. And I don't know, for me, the only way that happens is if I literally put it on my Outlook calendar. I have to put it there so somebody doesn't put a meeting there at the same time, so that my wife knows that that's what I'm going to do during that hour. Mm. Because if we don't take responsibility for doing that, who will?
Right.
Nobody is going to ask you except for you to get more sleep. Nobody's going to ask you except for you to get your exercise. So we have to take responsibility for scheduling. And I would say that in itself can be extremely important. Mm. But otherwise, there's some basic tenets that all come into the guise of, if you want to make it fancy, it's cognitive and behavioral therapy for insomnia, but it's just cognitive and behavioral therapy for sleep. Mm. One of them is keep a regular schedule as best you can. Try to figure out what your biological rhythm and work schedule, work-life schedule will allow, and find that, and then try to stick with that, even on weekends, even on vacations, as much as you can, try to keep that fairly regular. Mm. Second thing is, don't go to bed until you're sleepy. You really want to be mostly sleeping, and if you're in the right relationship, you know, having romantic activities, shall we say. Mm. But, you know, bed should not be the place where you're doing your work and your emails and having arguments and doing so forth and so on. Yeah. We know that because of classical conditioning, we're going to be more likely to sleep in our bed at night if that's what we do routinely. So don't go to bed until you're sleepy, and try to have that 7-hour window if you're an adult, you know, for sleep. And then if you come in, things do happen in life. Life is not always smooth. We know that God allows us to be challenged from time to time. Mm. So there will be stresses, and sometimes there'll be exceedingly joyful things that will cause your sleep to be disrupted. Don't spend a lot of time in bed frustrated. Get out of the bed and go do something until you feel that you are more likely to fall asleep, so that we really want, for the most part, to be sleeping in bed. We want that bed to just feel like a welcoming area that is just calling out to us to go to sleep. Yeah. So I don't know if those are helpful. Oh. Those are the things that come to my mind.
Oh, very helpful. I appreciated what you said. It needs to be a trigger. You gotta kind of guard the bedroom so that it's for sleep, and that you're not watching TV, working on emails, and all the things that can distract you. So I think that's very helpful. And, again, this book is all-encompassing. It's got so much great information in it. Certainly some of the things we just discussed are very actionable for the person themselves. I find that this book was very helpful in helping me think through some of the habits and the patterns in my own life. But also I think this book is going to be great for our young, you know, our trainees who think about how they can think about that as sleep as they're, you know, looking at their patients too. And because, you know, in this nexus of all these things that we deal with, you know, sleep seems to be very much a big part of it, often at the center of some of the issues that we can struggle with as humans. So it's it's a great book. And Tim, I appreciate you having taken the time to write this, you and your colleague. And this is a book we'll put in our show notes. So any of our listeners or those watching want to get a copy, I got mine on Amazon. So it's ready to go and available for purchase. Before we just wrap up, any closing remarks, anything left you thought unsaid that you'd like to say to those listening or watching?
Well, you know, to the extent that you might not be through your training yet, I'm going to make a plug for sleep medicine as something you should at least consider.
Okay.
So I've done, you know, pulmonary and critical care medicine. I did that for a large part of my career. But, you know, sleep medicine kind of won out as the thing that I have ended up enjoying the most. And, I think they're all valuable. I mean, we need each other to care for patients because medicine is so complex. But think about sleep medicine as a potential field. It's a great specialty. It allows for a good lifestyle, and you get to help a lot of people. You'll have a lot of very grateful patients. So I forgive me for that plug, but
no.
I couldn't help myself.
It's great. I'm glad you did it. Well, again, Dr. Tim Morgenthaler, thank you so much for this book, for your time today, and for all that you're doing. And again, appreciate you being a guest here on this episode of CMDA's Student Pulse Podcast.
Thanks very much, Bill.
Well, it's this time of the podcast where we tell you some things you need to know. As always, you can find CMDA Student Life on all of our social media properties using the handle and username CMDA Student Life. And you'll find us on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, X. And if you go to cmdastudentlife.org, you'll find a section in there for show notes. And so you'll be able to get all the important links that we discussed in this episode. Well, thank you again for joining us for this episode of CMDA Student Pulse Podcast. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time. CMDA's Student Pulse Podcast is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the organization. CMDA is non-partisan and does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Student Pulse Podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members.